Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, Executive VP of the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for Mr. Frank Gaffney, who is traveling around keeping the world safe for democracy and winning the fight for the free world. We have the pleasure to be joined this segment by Mr. Guy Taylor, who runs the national security team for the Washington Times. Guy, there's been a lot going on in your portion of the news world. And I think one of the things that you had been covering is the congressional folks and the folks with oversight on the Intelligence Committee seem to be wondering why it seemed like such a surprise that the Russians moved into Syria as quickly and as forcefully as they did. Can you tell us a little bit about what their concerns are?
Right. It's hard to tell whether this is just politics right now in terms of members in the House and Senate Intel Committees trying to slam the administration over not informing them or misreading Putin's moves in Syria. But there are members on both the House and Senate side, both Democrats and Republicans, who want to dig into the extent to which the CIA and other agencies have enough focus on Moscow at this point, because resources over the last 15 years have been focused on counterterrorism and cyber, and the bandwidth is somewhat thin these days for Cold War style spying on the Russians. And now with Putin's moves in the Middle East, and particularly the firing of these rockets from the Caspian Sea this week across about 930 miles into Syria, members of Congress seem to indicate that they were not warned by U.S. intelligence briefings, secret briefings that go on every week on the Hill, that might actually happen. So there's a bit of a blame game going on here between a few members who want to probably politicize this a little bit and say, well, the CIA is not doing its job. Now, there are some sober voices in it, particularly Adam Schiff, who is one of the more moderate Democrats on the House side, who came out, and he's really one of the only ones speaking publicly on this now, and he said, let's cool our jets a little bit. We have been getting these briefings. We're not going to open a formal investigation into this, but we do need to have a serious conversation about what our behind-the-scenes spying assets are for trying to predict whether or not Russia has even grander visions in mind with its Syria incursion, including some sort of massive regional collaboration with the Iranians that we're just blind to on this side of the world.
Yeah, Guy, I wish we were blind to it. I don't think we're blind to it. I think we see it coming. I think we've seen it coming, and I think President Obama has in many ways facilitated it, whether by openly acceding to it or whether by simply leaving a vacuum and, you know, knowing that some of these major powers, he's obviously empowered the Iranians. Whether he did the same with the Russians is a different question. But the idea that we didn't know, we saw General Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian terrorist lead from Quds Force, travel to Moscow and obviously was conducting negotiations with them over weapons and regional influence. And then, you know, not long on the heels of that, we see the Russians moving in. So enough of this was public. I think, you know, I think it's a fair point that the intelligence community should have known.
I think that multiple agencies in the wider intelligence community, okay, have known. And there's been a secretive conversation in Washington about it at certain levels for years here, not just the recent months. What's happening now is that Congress, in the wake of the Iran nuclear deal, and with all sorts of domestic political churn happening here, is sort of waking up to this and saying, wait a second, how do we weigh in? I mean, the Obama administration's Syria policy is just folding and collapsing on itself as we speak. And what's the way forward? And one of the ways forward is to potentially hold some intelligence hearings, which will draw serious public attention back to this to have the legislature possibly begin to shape a new policy. I don't know, you know, where that's going to go at this point, but I agree with you that, that certainly there are hawks on the Hill and certain elements of the think tank world that are all over this and have been warning about it for years. And I, you know, so this is one of the reasons I'm skeptical that somehow the CIA dropped the ball on this. I think what's happened is we haven't had congressional focus on it outside of railing against the Iran nuclear deal, not making a judgment on that, just saying that's where the focus has been. Now I think there are members on the House and Senate intelligence committees are saying, you know, what exactly are we talking about here? We're talking about a power shift in the Middle East where the Russians are now having serious military assets filling this void that you've mentioned. And I think that's what sort of reared its head with this story this week of members complaining that you know, is the agency watching this or briefing us well enough on it?
Folks, we're talking with Guy Taylor, who leads the National Security Section at the Washington Times, and one of the main focuses of that group right now has to be the growing Russian influence in Syria and whether that portends a larger role in the region. Now, as I mentioned earlier, and I think it's become patently obvious, the Iranians are taking and have been given a larger role in to some extent by the Obama administration in both the war in Iraq against ISIS, and now they seem to be in some flavor of collaboration with the Russians to take on the Assad opposition and whatever elements of ISIS they decide to fight there. Do you think, or have you guys seen any level of collaboration, or do you think this is just two big dogs playing in the same area between Russia and Iran?
No, I think there's deep collaboration. There were a couple of very interesting but almost uncovered by the mainstream media hearings on Capitol Hill this week where there were some testimony pointed to a level of collaboration between the Iranians and the Russians that has been just far deeper than the administration wants to acknowledge or gets reported even in the English language media. I mean, it has been out there if you comb through here that the Russians, as the nuclear negotiations were going on, moved to sell basically a missile shield to the Iranians. Somehow were able to get through UN embargo loopholes to do it. The administration allowed it to happen. The Russians are also building several nuclear power plants for the Russians, which on its face looks like it could fit within the wider international diplomacy around Iran's nuclear program, but at the end of the day, that involves the transfer of all kinds of very sensitive nuclear technology between Russia and Iran. And now they're aligned under this backing of the Assad regime that the Iranians have been doing subversively for years, but it's that party's out of the closet now. They're doing it together very openly. The question is, how does this affect Iranian meddling in other conflicts in the Middle East, particularly Yemen, where there's a hot proxy war between the Iranians and the Saudis? The idea is that Russian intervention, military intervention in Syria, will create some breathing room for Iran's biggest proxy, the Lebanon-based Hezbollah, which most of Washington declares as a terrorist organization, that Hezbollah elements could go and help Iranian proxies in Yemen either in person or with some sort of material and weapon support. We're talking about some significant distance geographically between these two different parts of the Middle East. However, it's about focus for Tehran. If there's less pressure on the Iranians to try and hold up the Assad regime in Syria, they can focus their efforts on fighting the Saudis in Yemen through the Shiite Houthi rebel group there. That could change the tide in that conflict, which the United States has been trying to work on the Saudi side with. So you've got the pieces aligned for a kind of U.S.-Saudi matchup against Russia-Iran now in the Middle East. President Obama came out a week ago today and tried to push a talking point that what Russia was doing in Syria is not going to drag the United States into some big proxy war with this Soviet-style Russia on one side, with Iranians and the U.S. on the other side, with the Saudis. However, if you look at this whole situation from 30, 40,000 feet, it's hard to dispute that that's actually what is happening, whether we like it or not.
Folks, we've been talking with Guy Taylor. He is a national security lead for the Washington Times. And up next, we will be talking with Mr. Tom Nichols of the Naval War College. This is Jim Hansen doing Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and we're joined this segment by Tom Nichols, who is the professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and someone I enjoy sparring with and talking on Twitter about the issues of the day. It's one of those entertaining things, Tom. I think if we only talk with people we always agree with, we get nowhere. So I find testing my ideas out against you seems to be a good thing. I wanted to jump into our well-developed mess we have in Iraq and Syria now, including Russia and Iran. One of the developments that I thought was a major step in the wrong direction was the Russians launching some cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea across both Iraqi territory, over the heads of the U.S. In the guise of attacking targets in Syria. Do you see that as much of a shot across the bow of us and everyone else as it appeared to me to be?
It's literally a shot across the bow, the way they did it. And it's surprising in terms of the audacity, I suppose, but it's not surprising when you put it in the context of thinking about everything Russia's doing as pretty much political signaling to the rest of the world that Russia's back. I think a lot of people have gotten confused by looking at Russia. And certainly the White House seems to be confused about this, saying, well, you know, they're going to get into a quagmire and there's no real exit strategy. They're asking all the questions Americans would ask themselves, which is totally to miss the point about why the Russians are there. They're there to prove they can do it. They're flexing their muscles. They're showing they have a right to be there. They're making it clear that they'll send their military and use force where they want to send their military and use force. And I think they're doing that, you know, pretty confidently right now.
We are talking with Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. You mentioned, and I think you're spot on in saying that the Russians want to be back in the big game. Putin, in particular, is a power player who may be in trouble, you know, politically at home, but knows that being a strong big dog on the world stage can take a little bit of that pressure off. So do you think there's a chance that this is a chance for the Russians to bring themselves back to, if not superpower status, pretty close to it?
Well, they don't even have to bring themselves to it. We've ushered them in and escorted them and showed them the best table in the house. if you think about how much has changed, you know, 42 years ago, when the Soviets told us that they wanted to intervene in the Yom Kippur War in 1973, Nixon went to a heightened state of nuclear alert to prevent the presence of Soviet troops in the Middle East. And now, you know, over 40 years later, we're sort of waving our hands and saying, well, what are you going to do? You know, if the Russians want to be there, they're going to be there. There's not much we can do about that. We're not that interested in it. So it's, I mean, on the one hand, it looks like the Russians are playing a very daring game. On the other hand, they're moving into all this completely unopposed and really even with our tacit blessing. So I think that the Russians probably can't believe their own good fortune in this. I think Putin every morning must think, I can't believe I'm getting away with this stuff.
But it kind of harkens back to my idea that President Obama doesn't want to be the indispensable nation or the world's policeman. And he's perfectly fine with the tyrants of the world, the other major powers like Iran, like Russia, taking a larger role because he's decided he's not going to. So whether there was a green light given to the Russians for this larger imposition of their will on the area, there certainly was no red or even yellow light given that it would be opposed. And as you said, that we would put up any kind of a fight. So given that, do you think the Russians may be looking at a longer term involvement in this entire area?
Well, whatever our other disagreements, this is a place I think you and I tend to agree pretty strongly, Jim, which is that this whole parcel of policies in the Middle East, and I would include the Iran deal and the reluctance to be involved in Syria and the fumble over getting rid of Bashar Assad's chemical weapons, that the golden thread that underlies all of it is that the president has simply decided, look, America needs to be out of the superpower game, and it especially needs to be out of the superpower game in the Middle East. And I think that's in part because he took the message when he was elected in 2008, you know, to be fair to the president, I think a message that was sent by a fair number of the American people saying, look, whatever you're going to do, don't be George Bush. But I think he's taken that a little far to say, well, you know, I'm not going to be George Bush, but I'm also
you know, it's one thing to say we're not going to do any more discretionary military conflicts in this area. It's another thing to say we're simply going to back up and walk away. And whoever wants to fill that vacuum, whether it's Iran or Russia or anybody else, is welcome to it. It's kind of strange because if you think about it, conservative realists tend to be the people who talk about that really all they want is stability and, you know, morality and those issues kind of come second. And yet here's President Obama, it seems to me, at least in my personal opinion, is making exactly the same determination. He said, well, you know, if the Iranians and the Russians can stabilize the area, you know, what do we care if they're bad guys and inimical to our interests and all of that? So I think the Russians, I'm not sure the Russians are settling in for a long haul here, but I think everybody, I think every bad guy in the world has decided that at least until January 2017, the candy store is open and they might as well just fill their pockets.
And unfortunately, they are. I think the larger problem, which stems from what you just mentioned, you know, our disengagement as, if not the world's policeman, at least the world's large guy standing there on the sidelines with his arms folded saying, you might not want to do that. The more we are not there to at least provide some sort of deterrent for expansion by everyone, makes the possibility that a Shia and Sunni hot war could develop because of the fact that there's nobody there saying this is a bad idea. We've lost our influence. Do you think that's a possibility?
Oh, I think the number of ways that the situation in the Middle East can go wrong in the absence of an American presence is kaleidoscopic. I mean, there's every time you know, turn the eyepiece, a different pattern will emerge, and they're all bad. You know, the notion of America as the world's policeman is really a red herring. If you think about it as the United States as the world's leading citizen, the most powerful country in the world, the economically largest country in the world, and so on, you know, the world just doesn't, we don't have to be indispensable, but we can't be AWOL. And I think that's the problem, that we're simply kind of pulling out, and we're hoping. Everything is built, you know, I suppose it's appropriate, right? Hope and change. But everything is built on hope and wishful thinking. The whole Iranian business, from the Iran deal down through this kind of, I won't say blind eye, but this sort of benign neglect that we're looking at with Syria, is all predicated on the idea that Iran will change. Well, you know, once they feel more comfortable, once they don't feel threatened, once they feel like they have a stake in the region, they'll change. That's purely mirror imaging, American ethnocentrism at work, and just a lot of wishful thinking about how we hope it will go and what we would want. But as you know, you're a veteran with long experience in this stuff. You don't plan on what you want the enemy to do. You plan on what the enemy's capable for. And we're making the classic kind of strategic mistakes that people make when they get too wrapped up in wanting to get away from situations where they need a lot of assumptions and wishful thinking to guide them out instead of hard-nosed thinking about what our responsibilities are, not just to the international community, not just in these regions, but to our own security, to our own people.
Folks, we have been talking with Tom Nichols, who is a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College and one of my favorite sparring partners on Twitter. You can find him at Radio Free Tom if you would like to see what he's talking about there. Coming up next, we will talk with Brent Scher about Hillary's emails and some of the same mess in the Middle East. This is Jim Hansen with Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. What a difference a day makes. Kevin McCarthy was the sure bet for House Speaker. Now he's toast. Today, the Boehner-McCarthy gang are anointing Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin congressman and former vice presidential candidate. Never mind that he says he doesn't want to stop serving as Ways and Means Committee chairman. Representative Ryan is an able and likable man. He may even be able to get the speakership if he does run, but that's not the same thing as saying he should. Republican voters do not want more of the same old, go-along-to-get-along GOP leaders and policies. They will stay home in droves next year if House Republicans don't seize this moment to begin the promised policy course correction by providing at last fresh, dynamic, and effective opposition to President Obama and his anti-constitutional agenda. This is Frank Gaffney.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Last week, the Obama bomb, Iran nuclear deal survived votes in the House and Senate with zero Republican support. The Obama administration and their supporters are trying to discount a powerful Republican criticism of this deal that there are secret side deals allowing Iran to inspect itself for nuclear activities. Critics claim the failure to provide these deals to Congress means the clock for congressional review never started and Obama cannot lift sanctions against Iran. Obama officials claim the side deals argument is a distraction, that these deals are not part of the nuclear agreement, and that they are part of a normal and private arrangement between the IAEA and Iran. The side deals are not a normal arrangement, and there are strong indications they were written by the Obama administration and hidden in secret side deals to conceal them from Congress. The side deals are not a distraction. They constitute national security fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and joined this segment by Brent Schur, who is a staff writer for one of our favorite publications, the Washington Free Beacon. Brent, I wanted to dig into that topic that never seems to stop giving, and I hope doesn't stop giving, at least until she's the prospective Democrat nominee, Hillary Clinton's email debacle. Now, it seems that every time we turn around, more emails seem to be popping up beyond what she managed to turn in of her own volition under pressure to the State Department. There are a couple interesting developments with where there are more backups and all that kind of stuff. Can you kind of fill us in as the state of play with where Hillary's work-related emails may be found these days?
Yeah, it seems like every week that new stuff comes out about the emails that just make it even more of a bizarre story. And this week was a particularly big week for that. First, it came out that a small IT firm in Connecticut was tasked with backing up all of the emails, and that the personal emails that were previously thought to be deleted and wiped from the server might actually be backed up on a cloud somewhere in a small Connecticut firm.
So we'll actually get her, we'll get her recipes and we'll get her favorite yoga positions, that breaking information will come out? Or is there a possibility she was lying about what she deleted and now we get a chance to compare it rather than having to trust her?
That's what it seems like might happen. And every time she said she's disclosed all of her emails in the past, it always seems like there are a few that somehow got missed. The Benghazi committee, Trey Gowdy, has said that there were at least 15 emails that should have been given to them that were not given. And as he's asking for them to be sent over and to get everything that they were promised that they'd get, they just don't come over. So hopefully if the FBI has seized the information that was stored in this Connecticut company, we could finally get some answers on whether Hillary Clinton was being completely honest when she said that the only emails she deleted were personal emails and she's given everything else over.
You know, I'm going to go out on the last limb of the last tree and say I doubt it. Now, this is not her original. She had this Platte River Networks company, which was running her email and had the server in the bathroom in Colorado and all that. This is another company that was doing backups for them. And the interesting thing, another piece that I thought that came out was some interplay where Platte River said they didn't know this cloud firm was doing offsite storage and that they'd been told by the Clinton camp to archive fewer emails along the lines. And they thought the whole thing was kind of sketchy themselves.
Yeah, the company is called Datto Inc. It's a small company that just does cloud storage in Connecticut. And yeah, it does seem that Platte River, the company that had her server, if I remember correctly, was oddly stored in a bathroom closet somewhere in Denver. Datto and Platte River were at odds, and I don't think that they were really working hand in hand. And it just shows really how much of a homebrew system this was by Clinton. I mean, the whole argument that you thought maybe could come out at the beginning when it came out that she had a private email server was maybe that it was even possibly more secure than being on the State Department system. But now it seems like she's using all these small companies that aren't even working hand in hand. Who knows how secure Datto Inc. is or how secure Platte River is. It came out in the emails that China was trying to hack into her emails already. So it really raises doubts about whether everything she was sending was in the eyes of foreign powers that could have gotten very classified information that she's been sending. I mean, and every single one of these things seems to indicate that what they were going for 100% was secrecy and not security. And I mean, when you look in their emails, you kind of see why they were going for secrecy. They were doing weird things, such as yesterday in a letter he wrote to his counterpart on the Benghazi committee, Trey Gowdy, said that they have emails with Hillary Clinton disclosing to her friend, Sidney Blumenthal, who's not in the State Department, he's not in the administration, he has no government position, disclosing in emails to him the name of CIA sources in Libya. I mean, it's absurd. She's showing that she was taking business directives from Sidney Blumenthal, who is invested in a private security firm in Libya. She was making decisions at the State Department, given intelligence he was claiming to have about how his security firm could help out. So Hillary Clinton, when she was at State Department, it seems like she had reasons to want secrecy. Now that this stuff's coming out, it's not going to look good for her, and it's not going to help her in her presidential campaign.
No, it's perfectly Clintonian in the way they were using government assets for their own. And her entire career has been nothing but one unethical, immoral, and in most cases, probably illegal step to bypass the systems and take care of herself. Folks, we're talking with Brent Scher, who's a staff writer for the Washington Free Beacon. Brent, another person who is very tight in the Hillary orbit, in most cases, her number two or number three person, is Huma Abedi. And Huma is implicated in a lot of the shenanigans going on in the email, and also was holding down two positions, while working with Hillary. She was working with the Clinton Foundation. She was working for a private consulting firm with a lot of very interesting connections around the world. And she was a special assistant through a waiver that Hillary got for her in the State Department. So she had access to all the State Department information. And it seems that there's a lot of communications that are going to come out between her and Hillary and her and these other organizations that may call into play whether or not she was being a straightforward actor. Was there some information this week you reported on being dropped about Huma by a conservative group?
Yeah, the conservative group is America Rising, which has picked up. They've been a research firm for years now focusing on Clinton. And Huma Abedin is one of the most interesting people to focus on in the Clinton camp because she's been so close to Hillary for so long. She's was a staffer when Hillary was a senator in New York. And the way the Clintons work is they take loyalty and the amount of time you've worked with them as more important than any expertise on anything. So Huma has gone from just a assistant in Hillary's Senate office to now being one of her most trusted advisors and is really close to her on everything she does. I would say she's probably kept abreast more than anybody on Hillary Clinton's daily thoughts on different things. So I think it's really valuable what America Rising is doing because for so long, characters like this in Clinton world have kind of gone under the radar. But now that Hillary Clinton is target number one for the right, everybody in her realm is getting examined.
Yeah, a well-deserved light shine on them. And I can tell you that the Center for Security Policy has done some, previous to all of this, pretty exhaustive investigation of Huma Abedin's background. And the problems go well beyond her current connections to the fact that both of her parents are deeply tied to the Muslim Brotherhood and that she herself, in younger days, worked for Muslim Brotherhood-associated organizations. So the idea that someone with that background was this close and this high up in the State Department hierarchy and still maintaining external clients and whatnot, I think I hope more people will take a deep look because when they do, they're going to find out that the connections are sketchy at best and probably worse than that. Folks, we have talked with Brent Scher, who is a staff writer for the Washington Free Beacon. Appreciate your insight on all of these issues. And up in our next segment, we'll be talking with Mike Pregent, who is director of Vets Against the Deal, opposing the Iran deal, and an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute. This is Jim Hansen doing Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen. We are joined now by Michael Pregent, who is director of Veterans Against the Deal, took a strong stand against the Iran nuclear deal, as an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute, and a former intelligence officer. And in that vein, Mike, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about what is going on with the Russian bear moving in a very powerful way into the Iraq-Syria area of operations, and really rattling a lot of cages. The amount of horsepower that they've brought into play is pretty impressive. You think this is a sign of things to come?
Well, it's a game changer, and it definitely complicates the situation for us. As you saw today, we're going to suspend our Syrian rebel training program. It wasn't successful to begin with, based on the vetting system in place. But that sends a clear sign to our Sunni allies and Sunni military Ismailis in Syria that the West is no longer going to be there to help you out. And with Russia and Syria now, they're looking for friends, and they don't see very many.
Well, all right. Now, we've got one of the things that I thought was pretty outrageous, and we discussed this a little bit earlier on the show. But to me, the firing of cruise missiles from the Caspian over U.S. heads and everyone else's heads from there into Syria seemed to me, again, a literal shot across the bow, but a pretty huge provocation. And I don't know that we've shown anything but submission in response.
Yeah, I mean, the story there, like you said, is Russia's been able to secure Iranian and Iraqi airspace to launch cruise missiles against Sunni population centers. Again, they said there were some attacks on ISIS, but who knows, maybe those were some errant cruise missiles as well that actually hit in Raqqa, much like the ones that hit in Iran. It basically shows that Russia now is taking advantage of the Iran-Shia crescent to actually increase its leverage, increase its influence, and take a bite out of Syria. Everybody thinks they're going to Syria to fix Syria. They're not. They're going to Syria just to simply keep Assad in power.
So kind of like the deal we made with the Turks for the use of Incirlik Air Base, they weren't really going to kill ISIS. They just wanted an excuse to go and squash the Kurds that bother them.
That was very disappointing when they said they were going to join the fight against ISIS and they started bombing the very Kurds we were working with to retake Kobani from ISIS. So that's a big problem. But the thing with Russia now being in Syria, that changes Turkey's thought on this, their strategy. They're very concerned about Russian presence in Syria and now working with the Iranians.
And the Russians seem to be doing an awful lot to kind of stir things up with Turkey, violating their airspace. But the problem is Turkey is a NATO ally. We are treaty bound to come to their defense if Russia takes them on. I mean, do you see that as a pretty huge potential flashpoint?
Well, Erdogan went to Moscow to talk about this very issue and said, listen, I'm a member of NATO. I'm not sure the White House is very comfortable with that. But this may be the actual thing we need to be able to establish a no-fly zone in the north, because it would actually keep Russian aircraft from violating Turkish airspace. That would be something we should do now. We could still do it even with the Russians there based on the division of targets in Syria. I argue that the territory is already deconflicted because Russia's not hitting ISIS targets.
Folks, we're talking with Mike Pregent. He is executive director of Veterans Against the Deal, an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute. And I hesitate to mention this, but it does show that you are a bipartisan individual. He's also a contributor to the Daily Beast. Mike, I wanted to kind of take a look at some of the other implications for that theater. And now we released a book that I was one of the lead authors on called Cut Down the Black Flag, A Plan to Defeat the Islamic State, that called for a couple things, but among them, arming the Kurds and operating with the Kurds in Iraqi Kurdistan, and also arming and operating with the Sunni tribes who helped us defeat al-Qaeda in Iraq, the precursor to ISIS, and could potentially be the real force that knows the area, knows the people, and could take down ISIS in Anbar and the other areas where they operate. You had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal with Max Boot calling for what seemed like a similar, but I thought a very interesting twist on that. Let's train the Sunni tribes in Kurdistan. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
So we based that strategy on the loss of U.S. leverage with Baghdad, with the establishment of this Russian, Syrian, Iranian, Iraqi intelligence cell, and what will likely turn out to be a joint command center with the U.S. not being part of it. So the loss of U.S. leverage in Baghdad, well, one way to get it back is to move our training effort to Kurdistan, actually train the Kurds, the Sunnis that we actually need to retake Mosul. I got to remember, a lot of the Sunnis that left Mosul went to Kurdistan, went to those areas to seek refuge. So you already have the right Sunnis in Kurdistan that are able to actually help us with retaking parts of Mosul. All you got to do is take back an airfield, and that's where we are. Just take back a piece of Mosul, and that could work. But the real strategy is, you know, punish Baghdad for violating existing U.S. law, meaning U.S. money is going to Baghdad and somehow finding its way into the hands of Kitab Hezbollah, Asaf al-Haq, and Badr Corps, three Iranian-backed Shia militias that are not part of the solution here. They're securing actors, and they're not hell bent on defeating ISIS. They're hell bent on securing Shia sectarian fault lines and aiming weapons that way. And when I say that way, towards Sunni population centers in Fallujah and Ramadi. The Russians will do things in Iraq, and that's one of my major concerns, and that's why we talked about this piece also, talked about this in our the Wall Street Journal piece. Our training effort just became marginalized. We have 3,000 U.S. soldiers right now in Iraq that aren't going to be able to do their jobs effectively. Some would argue that they haven't been able to do them effectively yet because they've been constrained by numbers of personnel and by the actual training mission, by allowing Baghdad to vet the actual force that we're training. Here's the problem now, is that Russia's going to be willing to target areas that we're not willing to target. So the U.S. will look like it's complicit in the sectarian targeting and the heavy-handed tactics that Russia will use if it starts conducting airstrikes in Iraq. And I think that's a likely possibility in the next 60 to 90 days that we'll see an expansion of Russian airstrikes into Iraq.
And that, to me, is a complete abdication of not just the promises we made to the Sunni tribes and to the Kurds, but of our role as someone who can stop this from expanding into a much larger and worse situation. Now, let me ask a question. You talk about regaining leverage with the Baghdad government. Do you think there's still a chance to maintain an Iraqi federal government that encompasses the Shia dominated central government, the Kurds who have a nation state in all but name, and then the Sunni tribes who have been so poorly served by that Baghdad government? Wouldn't they all be better off if the Kurds had a state and the Sunni potentially had their own?
The argument that I make for that is the Kurds are happy to have a certain section of Iraq, the Shia are happy to have a certain section of Iraq. Sunnis want it all. The Shia want Kirkuk, the Kurds want Kirkuk, Sunnis want Kirkuk. So there's always something that everybody wants that will still lead to conflict. What we do know is in the next 15 months or so, not much is going to change. Situation is going to get worse. I mean, not much is going to change as far as actually being able to fix Iraq. It'll likely slide more into conflict. I'm concerned that ISIS will start being able to move into western Baghdad. Have you seen an increase in car bombs in western Baghdad, Saladin, and Diyala? And it's based on this, Prime Minister Abadi has a point. The U.S. isn't doing enough. We want Russia to come in and do more than the U.S. is doing. But that's, to those of us, and you know this better than anybody, Russian tactics, they have area denial weapons. They don't do precision strikes. They punish football fields. They punish city blocks.
And unfortunately, we're going to see the Russians doing that more. And the Iranians, and as you mentioned, those Iranian-backed Shia militias, exploiting this for their own gains, and there's going to be an awful lot of civilians caught in the crossfire. Mike Pregent, who is Executive Director of Veterans Against the Deal and an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute, pleasure to hear your insights on this, and keep working the issues. And that will do it for Secure Freedom Radio today. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, who will be back on Monday with more Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.